Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Stephen Gagnon. On the show this week, Nessun Nair from Sasfin Securities takes us through all the news making headlines globally. Then in our fund segment, Do Steenkamp takes us through the investment case for the Denker Sunlum Collective Investments Global Feeder Fund. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making the headlines. Well, Wall Street was optimistic on Friday after the Trump administration cleared a critical hurdle in its plans to cut taxes. Bank stocks rose along with a recovery in the tech sector. Analysts said Friday's events gave them hope that they'll continue to monitor developments. Battle Japanese steelmaker Kobe says it's lost customers to competitors because of widespread data falsification. The steelmaker's share price sank further on the news, adding to a 40% slide in less than 2 weeks that's wiped $1.6 billion off the company's market value. And Daimler's third quarter operating profits fell as the cost of making diesel engine cars run cleaner outweighed record sales of Mercedes-Benz models. The German firm spent €223 million to update over 3 million current and older Mercedes diesel models in Europe. Here's more.
A greener auto sector doesn't come cheap, and the cost of making cleaner diesel engine cars is beginning to squeeze car makers. Daimler's third quarter earnings plunged 14% to €3.46 billion, outweighing record sales of its Mercedes-Benz luxury models. The German firm spent €223 million last quarter to update over 3 million current and older Mercedes diesel models in Europe in a bid to curb pollution and help avoid driving bans.
It is a problem for the car industry, which has actually done rather well generally in terms of meeting the EU targets for reducing CO2 emissions and making their engines much more efficient. And I think the manufacturers have moved really quite fast, faster than some of the targets that had been set. There is no doubt that it's costly for the industry.
For Daimler, further bumps in the road are expected. A recall of more than 1 million passenger cars and SUVs to address potential unintended airbag deployments will add another €230 million in costs. There was good news at Daimler Trucks, though, the group's second largest unit by revenue. Earnings jumped by a third thanks to a boost in North America, where heavy truck orders rose to their highest in over 2 years in September. And third quarter deliveries of Mercedes luxury cars rose a record 7.9% thanks to demand for its SUV models.
Well, joining me in studio, Nessun Nair from Sasfin Securities. We can get to Daimler in just a moment. Maybe let's start with Trump, because it looks like he's finally getting his way with something, Nessun.
Yeah, listen, he campaigned on essentially three very large issues. You know, the whole healthcare, Obamacare repeal was one. Didn't quite get his way there. The other one was, you'll remember, relating to the security issues in the U.S., travel bans and walls that needed to be built. Didn't quite get his way there as well. But tax reform is a different thing. You know, I think it's as a senator, you know, when you have to vote for these things, it's you can become very unpopular if you're voting against somebody that's trying to cut taxes. So it looks like the path is clear now with the budget being passed in Congress yesterday. It looks like the path is clear for him to start implementing some of those tax changes. We'll just have to see.
And this, of course, is what Wall Street was waiting for, and this is what they liked coming through in Trump's campaign, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, the U.S. is probably the highest tax jurisdiction in the world, okay, and quite prohibitively so as well. So I think, you know, modernizing the tax system, I'm not sure he'll get the sort of aggressive cuts that he's talking about, from 35% to 25% or 20% corporate tax rate. You know, it just seems a little bit far-fetched. But you can't put anything down right now because, you know, we still have to see what happens. But it'll be a huge impact for the economy. I mean, a lot of more money in an economy that's already in a rising trend. You know, as you saw, the bank stocks, they're also outperforming. And a lot of the tech stocks as well that hold vast amounts of cash offshore because they can't bring it onshore because they'll have to pay tax on it.
This is going to add $1.5 trillion to the federal deficit over the next 10 years. Any concerns about that?
Listen, it's difficult to say what it's going to do because on the one hand, you know, by lowering taxes, you're effectively lowering revenue, and that creates a budget deficit. But on the other hand, and this is the harder one to model or to calculate, mm-hmm. What's the impact going to be on nominal GDP? I mean, what impact is the additional spending going to have on growing GDP? because remember your tax base is calculated on a growing GDP number. You know, the federal deficit is at all-time highs. It's yeah. 20 trillion or something now. You know, to throw another 1.5 trillion or 1.1 trillion into it, it's not really going to change things much. But I think for the U.S. right now, the thing we should be looking out for is for wage growth specifically. We've seen unemployment come to the 4% level, which is, you know, as full employment as they can probably hope for, I think. But this is going to translate into a tightening labor market, higher wages, which, you know, then translates into a more spending taking place.
Okay. Well, let's move across to Europe, and they're calling it high noon at the QE Corral. That's coming on Thursday. We've got the ECB meeting. And it's widely expected that they're going to trim asset purchases, but also extend the QE program, so push it out further. Well, what are you looking for there?
Listen, what are they doing now? About 60 billion or so. They're looking to cut that down to about 40 billion. I don't quite see the point of extending it. Maybe they just want to, you know, just turn the tap down a little bit, and let it run for a bit longer. But one gets the sense that the European economy is kind of stabilized. You know, we're seeing employment coming back through to peripheral Europe. Particularly in Spain. I mean, apart from the problem they've got in Catalonia now, you know, the Spanish economy, property prices in Portugal, Spain, that sort of seems to have more or less stabilized. I mean, the German economy is doing fantastically well. France has just got a new president, and the French stock markets, you know, if that's anything to gauge, I mean, it's one of the best performing this year. There's still the uncertainty around Brexit, and you know, I'd be cautious on that because we don't quite know how that's going to play out. But Europe generally seems to have all the ingredients, you know, to return back to a sort of sustained growth. Maybe the ECB is just being a little bit cautious, you know, cutting the extent of the of the stimulus, but just giving themselves the option to continue or to carry on should the exercise not work in its favor.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the constitutional crisis in Spain at the moment. Do you think the risks there are limited to Spain? Do you think there's a potential for a spillover effect to the European Union?
Listen, I think we may have seen a little bit of it in Germany, the German elections. You saw, you know, the nationalist, right-wing nationalist party get a lot more support. This issue with Catalonia has been on for as long as I can remember. But obviously, you know, it's getting quite heated up right now. A few years ago, we saw, you know, the Scottish referendum for independence from Scotland. I think it's more a structural story in Europe. I think there are a lot of concerns in Europe, especially around security, around the economy. You know, and we can expect these things, you know, to pop up every now and then. One just hopes that it doesn't come with the sort of violence that we've seen on TV, you know, and that people can actually sit down and negotiate properly in these circumstances.
Okay, well, let's look at some company news. Maybe starting off with those Daimler numbers. So third quarter operating profit was down, and it's really due to the high cost of making those cleaner diesel engines.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's if you go and look for value in Europe, if you just looked at it on a PE basis, I mean, most of these German automakers stack up because a lot of them are on like 6-7 PEs and the rest of the market's on double digits, you know. When you see results like this, you kind of, you know, check back to reality. There's a reason why that they're at such low valuations. You know, the cost of putting together, you know, these automobiles to meet the very stringent emission regulations in Europe is a lot higher than what we can imagine it.
Yeah.
Sometimes or we can even model it. I think last week as well, we had the news that the German authorities had raided the offices of BMW, you know, and for suspected collusion in the pricing of parts going back to 1990. So there's some headwinds in the industry that's keeping these valuations quite low. I mean, what was interesting was the Mercedes truck division, you know, was able to grow sales in North America. So, I mean, that does provide us, you know, with evidence, sufficient evidence, I think, that the U.S. economy is definitely on a continued upswing because, you know, the transportation index is one of the leading indicators for a sustainable growth there, I think.
Okay. Kobe Steel, a Japanese company, we chatted about them last Monday as well, and they have been losing customers, so I think it broke just over a week ago that they had been falsifying data. And I suppose this has knock-on implications for the car sector, for a start, because they use the steel that comes from Kobe, but also for aircraft manufacturers.
Yeah, very unusual to find a Japanese company involved in this sort of thing, because Japanese industry and Japanese culture prides itself on being honorable about these things. So it's one that's going to unfold. I think there's a few things behind this, but I think just the pressure on the global steel industry. China has basically taken market share away from the rest of the world when it comes to steel production over the last 10 to 15 years, and I think there may be situations like this where executives at these big steel companies are so under pressure and so desperate that they're resorting to these sort of measures. But it'll be an interesting story to watch, because I think there's still a bit more news flow to come from this.
Let's see if anybody commits harakiri over this. General Electric, third quarter profit missed estimates by a wide margin. And I read somewhere that General Electric is the Dow's worst performer this year so far.
Oh, absolutely. I think, it started off the year at about $30-odd. Where's it now? 22. I saw it was 4% down today as well. At the time the news came out in pre-trading, it was down 8%. Managed to recover on Friday. But I think if you look at the problems, they've got four large divisions, an aviation division, a healthcare division as well, where they make those MRI machines. But the division that had a problem now was the power division and the oil and gas division.
Yeah.
Now, it's strange, oil and gas, because if you look at where the oil price has been, but I suppose, that is the cyclical nature of the business. But the power business, they've invested a lot of money in the power business. I think the profit was halved. It came down from $1.2 to $1.3 billion to like $600 million. So I think that had a huge impact on the bottom line. And of course, the outlook wasn't good as well.
Yeah.
So investors will look at the outlook statement, and you've had a management reshuffle there. I think the new guy, John Flaherty, I think his name is, has come in and he's basically been put in the hot pot. Eh?
Mm. Buying opportunity, perhaps?
Listen, we have in a lot of client portfolios. We bought it at
I mean, is this the blue chip, the ultimate blue chip, or was previously?
It was. They streamlined the business. Remember, they had a massive
financial services
yeah. business, which they unbundled. It seems that, one should have held onto into the unbundled shares now and sold General Electric. I mean, hindsight is a perfect science, because the financial services business is doing quite well. But this is a huge company. And it's got an entrenched position in a lot of markets. I think we just need to give them some time.
Okay, and Procter & Gamble, sales growth also down, and apparently less demand for grooming products, so maybe the metrosexual has left America.
Yeah, I think that was in the Gillette division. You could hardly call it a close shave. But it's one of those shares that has caught the eye of a lot of shareholder activists now, looking at these big conglomerates. Unilever is another one, Nestle is another one. Shareholders are beginning to say to management teams in these big organizations that we expect to have some value returned to us, either in the form of share buybacks, dividends, corporate restructuring. And it's just an unfortunate timing for Procter & Gamble, I think, to come through and with this sort of result, especially when everything else in the S&P seems to be doing so well.
Yeah, well, perhaps when the hipster phase goes out, people will start shaving again and start buying some more razors. Right, we're going to a short break. When we come back, we take a look at the Denker Sanlam Collective Investments Global Feeder Fund. That's with fund manager Doos Steenkamp. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor. Still with me in studio, Nesan Nair from Sassman Securities. We're also joined on the line by Doos Steenkamp to look at the Denker Sanlam Collective Investments Global Feeder Fund. And Doos, thanks very much for chatting to us this evening. So in a nutshell, what are you getting when you buy this Global Equity Feeder Fund?
Stephen, the Global Equity Feeder Fund previously was known as the Sanlam Global Best Ideas Fund. And it is a global fund which invests predominantly in developed markets.
And as a feeder fund, you're investing in RAMs in this side, so there's no taking your money offshore or anything, is there?
No, as a feeder fund, you are investing rands into the global fund, which is domiciled in Ireland and managed from there.
Okay, and I have Nesan Nair in studio, and he pointed out, wasn't Corky Coyman involved with the Global Best Ideas Fund?
Yes, Corky started this fund and managed it until 2014 when I took over from him. And Corky is still involved because we are fortunate to be able to rely on him for his insights in the financial sector, and he works quite closely with us in selecting those shares in that sector.
Okay. Well, take us through the share selection for the fund, Doe, because you say in the commentary that you're looking for the undiscovered and the neglected shares that you can find. So it's a value fund, isn't it?
It is definitely a value-biased fund, yes. We tend to focus very much on company fundamentals and valuation in selecting the shares.
So you don't have any of those big name Facebooks and Netflix included in the portfolio?
We don't. We do have a holding in Alibaba, which we've had quite a close look at in conjunction with our emerging markets colleagues. And we believe that that share offers quite a lot of value.
Mm. Nesan, your thoughts on value funds at the moment, because they have underperformed the overall markets, and it's really momentum that's been driving the upswing we've seen.
Yeah, I think, both in South Africa and globally, I mean, if you look at the tech sector, for example, it's largely driven now by Facebook, Amazon, Google, Netflix, those sort of companies, which have very little earnings in comparison to their share prices. So, but it's... I think the outlook for those internet businesses, I think, is what people are really looking at. And the potential for them, to accrete customers. Like, we see Facebook's got something like 2 billion customers now. I mean, never in the history of humanity has one company been able to reach 2 billion people, at the click of a mouse. So, and I think people are kind of using their imagination, really, to see or to try and understand the potential earnings impact of businesses like that. That doesn't mean to say that, companies that offer value are not necessarily good investments, because I think, investment themes kind of have a kind of like fashion from time mm-hmm. to time. And at this point in time, momentum is certainly in vogue. The good thing about value fund managers is they're very patient. I mean, you have to be patient to be a value fund manager. And, you look for the opportunities, you make your investment, and you basically forget about it until... the market picks its head up and looks at it and says, but hey, there's value here. And then everybody starts buying it. And at that stage, it becomes a momentum stock. So, it's one of those things, I think, from an investor's point of view, you've got to have patience and the returns will come.
Mm. So, Doe, are you being patient here, waiting for those returns to come?
Yes, we are very patient. In fact, if you look at the turnover of our fund, it is relatively low, so we turn the fund over less than 20% a year. In other words, we are what we say we are, which is long-term investors. And maybe on the point of being value investors, that I'd hate to be put in the box that says we only buy shares that are on very low PEs or single-digit PEs. We always evaluate the company relative to what we believe the business is worth, and then buy when we think that it's trading at a discount to that. That doesn't necessarily mean that the companies always have to be on single-digit PEs. So there are examples of shares in the fund that people would look at and say, well, that doesn't look very cheap. But that might be because they don't fully understand the value that is locked up in a business like that.
Mm. Give us an example of a share like that that may not appear cheap, but you are seeing value in.
Okay, I think the best example is probably a share called ASML, which is a company in the tech sector. It trades on a multiple in excess of the market multiple. And what this business does is it manufactures the machines, or a machine which is a very important component in the manufacturing process of silicon chips. And what attracted us to this business is that as of about 2 or 3 years ago, they have a monopoly, a global monopoly, because the technology has become so difficult that their competitors have basically folded their cards and thrown in their hands. So this business, ASML, today is the only place where you can buy these lithography machines for the very small, sort of 7-micron-sized silicon chips. And we believe that the way the world is moving, the demand for chips is only going to increase, especially as we see the world moving towards what they call the Internet of Things, where every device in your house is eventually going to have a chip in it. We just think that the outlook for this business is very bright, and that's not reflected in its current share price.
Okay. Although you don't have any of the fangs, well, you actually do have one of the fangs in your top 10. You've got some big name companies there, so Microsoft, Philip Morris, Unilever, JP Morgan as well. Clearly you are seeing value in those holdings.
We do, yes. Especially it's interesting, I overheard you earlier talking about the information technology shares. So we own some of the old stalwart companies, and we have quite a big exposure to companies like Microsoft, Cisco, and Oracle. Those are all names from the start of the information technology sector. And those are all survivors of the dot-com bubble in 2000. And what we found with these businesses is that they've largely reinvented themselves for the new environment. But they remain very strong incumbents. So companies like Microsoft, Cisco, Oracle have very big global market shares, typically in excess of 50% in their core businesses. And they've generally been moving their customers from a model where you pay up front for the product to a model where you're now paying for a subscription. So if you think about Microsoft, they're moving all their customers onto the Outlook 365. So there's been a period of adjustment. The revenue line has sort of stalled for a while, but we can see that now starting to grow, and we believe that these businesses are significantly undervalued, given the franchises that they've established over the last 20 years.
I mean, shares that you'd feel comfortable with in your portfolio, Nesson?
Listen, we hold more the content providers, which so happen to be the little bit more expensive ones. In the IT investment arena, if you can call it that, I mean, you can buy equipment companies like a Cisco, for example, Microsoft, which is really the Microsoft Cloud and things like Office, Microsoft Office, that is, I think, ubiquitous. Everybody's got that. But what we like is more the internet-type companies, so the Googles, Facebooks, Amazon, and the ones that actually provide content. So Amazon is probably a very good example of the sort of company we're looking for because, it's an e-commerce platform, really the biggest in the world. It produces content, video content, video-on-demand content, they call it, through Amazon Prime. And it's also got a very big cloud business, Amazon Web Services. So those are the sectors that we like to play in, and Amazon just happens to be a big player in those three sectors, which is why we invested in that. We have a different outlook on what we like to invest for growth.
Okay. Geographically, your benchmark is the MSCI World Equity Index. And I suppose geographically, I mean, you're more than 50% invested in the United States, which I suppose would reflect what the MSCI world is as well.
Yes, we currently have a slight underweight as exposure to the U.S., and that's changed in the last few months because we used to have an overweight exposure to the U.S. So if you look at the sectoral breakdown, we have a fairly significant overweight to the U.K., where we think that post-Brexit, there's some very interesting opportunities there. And then we have no exposure to Japan, which is a fairly large component of the benchmark. And we've traveled to Japan a few times, and honestly, I just can't get my head around the kind of valuations of those businesses. So we have essentially an underweight Japan, overweight UK.
Okay. Your thoughts on the overweight UK there?
Listen, you know, at first glance, you know, it's obviously when one thinks of Brexit and things, you get the impression that, 17% exposure to the UK and only 14% to continental Europe, you know, I would have probably gone the other way. In fact, I would probably gone up to the mid-20s in continental Europe and maybe the single digits in the UK. But having said that, there's a lot of South African companies that are investing in the UK now. I mean, we saw the big deal Alliance Medical that Life Healthcare bought into last year. Then First Strand announced a $1 billion odd, £1 billion deal recently, Aldermore, that they were looking to invest in. So one just gets the impression that it's probably a good idea just to keep an open mind about the UK, notwithstanding the Brexit issues. But, you know, if you take a view, then the potential opportunities certainly there.
Over the longer term, you have lagged the benchmark, and I don't know if that's because of your deviation geographically or what. Over a one-year basis, you are beating the benchmark. So do you think things are turning around?
Yes. Well, we certainly hope so. What's really started to work for us is some of those holdings that we put into the fund in around 2014, 2015, when we took over this fund. Incidentally, I must just mention at this point that the fund is co-managed. So I have a co-portfolio manager, a gentleman by the name of Pierre Marais, and he's been co-managing the fund with me since 2015. So some of the holdings that we put into the fund sort of 2 years ago have started to really work for us, and we hope that that's going to continue.
And looking forward, where are you seeing the big opportunities at the moment, the new unloved stocks?
Yeah, well, we always approach this question from the bottom up. So we tend to invest in businesses that are attractive to us rather than taking some kind of top-down view of the market. So if you look at the sector allocation of the fund, you can see that we have 28% invested in financials. So clearly we see quite a lot of value there. And in those deliberations, we speak to Cookie quite a lot, and Cookie has some very clear views there. And then in the information technology, and we've spent quite a bit of time tonight talking about that already, but we have exposures there to companies like Microsoft, Cisco, the ASML I spoke of, a very interesting little company called Micro Focus that we invested in a number of years ago and has actually done really, really well for us. And then we have some holdings in Samsung. So we've got quite a wide exposure there. In the healthcare space, we've got a reasonable exposure to healthcare devices companies. So these aren't typical pharmaceutical companies. They're the guys who sell syringes and drips and those disposable type items to hospitals. And we're finding that those companies are growing very, very healthily and very predictably. And most of them are growing quite a lot into emerging markets. So even though they're US-based businesses, most of the growth is taking place into emerging markets, and those are quite attractive.
Okay, I'm afraid we're out of time. We have to leave it there. But thanks so much for taking us through the fun tonight.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks again to our guests, Doe and Nesson, for their insights. Many thanks to you for watching. Same time next week. Goodbye.